Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What role did Native Americans play in the U.S.-Mexican War? Traditional historical accounts have focused on the relationship between the expanding United States and the newly independent Mexico. But those accounts often gloss over a key factor not only in the U.S.'s assessment that it could take Mexican territory it wanted by force, but in Mexico's losing battle to retain control over thousands of square miles of disputed land. In fact, Indian raids on Mexican settlements had weakened Mexican defenses and thinned its northern population for more than a decade, making the territory ultimately impossible for Mexico to defend. And those raids shaped the way Americans and Mexicans saw each other and their potential for a successful war. Brian DeLay is assistant professor of history at the University of Colorado at Boulder. He writes about all this in his new book, War of a Thousand Deserts, Indian Raids and the U.S.-Mexican War. Brian, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
It's easy to forget this, but even through the mid-1800s, huge portions of the Americas were not really controlled by any state, which made for a very different sort of political climate.
That's absolutely true. I mean, it's probably the case that say around 1821, when Spain lost control of its American colonies, that more than half of the continental landmass of the Americas was still controlled by independent Indian peoples. And, you know, one of the ironies is that this is something that's now a key feature of the historiography and of the way that people think about the past relating to the colonial era. You know, it's now impossible to talk about things like the Seven Years' War or the American Revolution without taking seriously Indian peoples and their political and economic ambitions. But once we get into the middle of the 19th century, and once we're out of the colonial era and into the era of independent nation states, we're less accustomed to thinking that way. But it is definitely the case that Native people still control vast amounts of territory, including most of the territory that Mexico and the United States went to war over.
Where were Indian nations located on the Southern Plains in the years leading up to the war?
Well, there were many different Indian communities that were important for Mexico that were occupying the whole of northern, what then was northern Mexico prior to 1846. And most of these were independent. That is to say that the Mexican government had no control over what these people did or how they comported themselves, who they made deals with, and so forth. And this ranges from many different tribes of Apaches all the way in what's now Sonora or modern-day Arizona, and then working their way east, other groups of Apaches, and then onto the Southern Plains, Comanches and Kiowas, who occupied shifting territories in just below the Arkansas River, sometimes above the Arkansas River in what's now the Texas Panhandle.
So the Mexican government, you say, had no control. Can you talk about, though, why things got so much worse after independence was gained from Spanish colonialism?
Sure. It is the case that as Spain expanded into this far northern territory, up into New Mexico and Texas, during the late 17th and early 18th centuries, that they came into conflict with Indian peoples who were becoming far more formidable in their own right because they acquired horses and eventually because they acquired guns. And so in the 18th century, there was a period of intense warfare and massive destabilization in northern New Spain. But this came to a conclusion around the 1780s, 1790s, as Native peoples and Spanish administrators came to the conclusion that it was in their interest to have a more productive relationship, one that was based on trade and diplomacy and so forth. So that's there's a relative period of peace that lasts from, say, the 1790s up through the early part of the 19th century and even past Mexican independence in 1821. But something happens in 1821, which is that because of the disruptions of the War for Independence, Mexico's War for Independence, which lasted from 1810 to 1821, Mexico really lost its ability to focus on northern diplomacy and to bring resources to bear on these sparsely populated northern regions. So relationships with Indian peoples, and you know, these individual relationships differed dramatically depending on which group we're talking about, Navajos, different tribes of Apaches, Comanches, Kiowas, but overall they begin to really decline as Mexicans are not able to bring diplomatic resources to bear and bring resources for Indian leaders that might help convince them that the peace was worthwhile. And at the same time, Mexicans are not able to project the same kind of military power onto the region. So Native peoples are increasingly aware of the fact that should they decide that this relationship is no longer profitable, Mexico would not be in the position that its Spanish forebears were to economic and for political reasons after independence.
Yeah, so they're not getting resources from the Mexican or the Spanish government, which had happened before. And there's no consequence, really, to making these raids on settlements of colonists, rather of settlers from Mexico.
Well, you know, again, it varies a lot depending on which group we're talking about. Mm-hmm. So in New Mexico, for example, Navajos got into all kinds of conflicts with Mexicans living in New Mexico. But these conflicts were almost always losing bets for Navajos. They lost far more people through capture and through killings than they were able to inflict on Mexicans. And that just has to do with their particular relationship and the way that they lived in New Mexico. Apaches, on the other hand, Apaches and Mexicans living in places like Sonora and Chihuahua, they got locked in a really terrible long-term conflict where both sides were losing greatly. So, yes, the Apaches would come down. They would raid sparsely populated ranches and haciendas, kill many people, steal animals, capture some people. But Mexicans themselves would launch retaliatory attacks into Apache territories and inflict the same sorts of damages. The real dramatic difference comes when we look at the southern plains, the Comanches and Kiowas. Here we're talking about people that lived well above the Rio Grande, and especially after the loss of Texas in 1836, Mexicans are no longer able to exert any kind of credible military threat onto this region, despite the fact that they dearly want to. So what happens is that large parties of Comanches and Kiowas, beginning in about 1833, 1834, begin coming down below the Rio Grande and raiding different states. By 1845, this is about seven Mexican states that they're traversing and launching, as I say, these devastating attacks to which Mexicans can only respond on the ground. They can only try to be reactive and go after raiders when they see them. They can't go above the river and try to preemptively attack Comanche families and compel them to stop this war that way.
Brian DeLay is my guest. He's assistant professor of history at the University of Colorado at Boulder. His new book is called War of a Thousand Deserts, Indian Raids and the U.S.-Mexican War. So you talked about them coming and stealing animals. Another thing that these raiders wanted to have was captives. Can you talk about how they were used?
Certainly. It was in the regional culture, it was the case that for a very long time, enemy peoples would be captured, women and children especially, and integrated into these new communities. And again, this happens across cultural lines for almost all peoples that we know about in the historic and even perhaps even the prehistoric Southwest. This certainly extends into the 1830s and the 1840s, where Comanches and Kiowas, one of the things that they were interested in acquiring below the river were Mexican women and children who they could do one of any number of things with. They could integrate them into their own communities, and they would be adopted by families, essentially, and raised as low-status kin, and they themselves may end up becoming prominent people in that community as they grew to adulthood. It's also the case that in the 1830s and 1840s, as more Americans were moving in, Texans were having more and more presence on the western prairies and on the plains, and as removed Indians, people who were forced from eastern North America, forced east of the Mississippi in the 1820s, 1830s, 1840s, as these people were trying to build market connections with Indians living further west, that there were more and more opportunities for Comanches and Kiowas, to a lesser extent, to sell captives as commodities. And so they engaged in this as well. They would barter captives for, say, bridles or textiles or guns and ammunition.
So as all this is going on, there's sort of chaos on the plains. The Mexican government, which is still in control of this territory, has its own problems with internal coups, isn't really able to focus on any of this.
That's certainly the case. Mexico enjoys a period of relative stability after independence and after it establishes its initial Federalist Constitution in 1824. And so for a few years, there is a sense among many in Mexico that the chaos and disruptions and the poverty of the previous years are behind us, and we are now going to embark on the construction of a modern, prosperous, secure nation state. But there are many things that stood in the way of that goal. Most fundamentally, the Mexican government was never able to secure a reliable financial supply, never able to secure a steady supply of tax revenues. And so the Mexican government operated initially by acquiring loans from foreign nations, most especially Great Britain, in the 1820s. But because they didn't have any kind of revenue stream, eventually the Mexican government defaults on these loans and is unable to acquire any others from international lenders. So they're locked in a cycle where they have to take these ruinous short-term loans from lenders, most especially inside Mexico, just to keep the government functioning, just to feed the army, and just to attend to immediate crises, including these rebellions that you mentioned, which were happening with increasing speed all over Mexico in the 1830s and into the 1840s. So the Mexican government is always in a state of crisis after about 1830. It is always extremely reactive and trying just to survive, trying to make sure that the sitting administration isn't overthrown in a coup or displaced because of a rebellion. And this meant that when northerners across a huge expanse of their territory would write these impassioned pleas for resources and for guns and ammunition and attention and support, the Mexican government always had the attitude of, well, this is certainly a pity that this is happening up there, but that's more in the order of a crime wave. And what we're dealing with here are these crucial problems that could threaten the very existence of the country. So you'll get your resources as soon as we get a hold of these other problems.
One of the solutions that the Mexican government took, I understand, to regional settlers being very upset and sort of trying to protest against the government was to disarm them, essentially leaving them defenseless against Indian raids.
Well, you know, this is something actually that you see often in history books. And I assumed that that would be the case, but I've not found positive evidence that that actually happened. It certainly is the case that across the North, people were far worse off when it came to arms than their Indian enemies were. And this was a source of constant complaint, obviously. And in a place like Zacatecas, where this is a powerful populous state in kind of north-central Mexico, it is the case that they had a major rebellion against the centralist government in the 1830s, and as a consequence of that rebellion, they were disarmed, or to a large extent they were disarmed, and their militia was crushed. And then years later, they too become victims to these massive Indian raids, and so they can complain in that way. But I didn't actually find evidence that the government consciously disarmed people that they knew were under attack by native peoples.
There are great natural resources in Mexico. Why did the federal government have such a hard time establishing a viable tax structure and getting itself the revenue it needed to operate completely?
Well, you know, it's a pretty complicated question, and a lot of it has to do with authority, that the Mexican government, the successive Mexican government, simply never had this kind of credibility and authority that Spanish officials had in the colonial period. And they, therefore, found it far more difficult to manage elites in different regions of the country who really wanted to be left alone. You know, okay, we're going to make the whatever sorts of gestures we need to the national government, but we're going to maintain our interests and protect our resources, and there's nothing you can do about it. So there's quite a lot of fragmented regional thinking going on in Mexico, not a lot of authority from the federal government, and also huge expenses. I mean, unlike in the United States, after the War for Independence in Mexico, the army not only maintains its size, but in some cases grows and remains enormously ravenous of funds. And this is so partly because Spain takes a very long time to recognize Mexico's independence, and there's always fears that Spain will try to reinvade and reacquire Mexico for its empire. And it's partly because, again, of the regional nature of Mexico, powerful generals in different parts of the country were very reluctant to see their budgets slashed. And individual administrations are so precarious that if they didn't placate the army, then they weren't going to be in power for very long.
Brian DeLay is with us. He is Assistant Professor of History at the University of Colorado at Boulder. His new book is called War of a Thousand Deserts, Indian Raids and the U.S.-Mexican War. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can follow your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Brian DeLay. He is Assistant Professor of History at the University of Colorado at Boulder. His new book is called War of a Thousand Deserts, Indian Raids and the U.S.-Mexican War. If you want to join the conversation, you can send an email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Brian, how did Indian raids play into the Anglo-colonization of Texas and the rest of what was then northern Mexico?
Well, Texas had long been a place that was very sparsely populated by Spaniards in the 18th century, and where Spanish authority really only was said, you know, you could say that it was in control of things only around San Antonio and a couple other towns. Most of that region was in the control of powerful Indian peoples, Apaches, Comanches, and others. And Texas grew very slowly, even in comparison to a small place like New Mexico, into the early 19th century. But beginning in 1810 with the War for Independence, this small population, which had been growing rather steadily and was quite hopeful that they'd see better days ahead, plunged into a real nightmare situation where, because of its proximity to the U.S. border, rebels and forces for the king fought fiercely over Texas. And so Texas really emerges from the War of Independence in tatters, smaller population, many fewer animals, the economy in shambles. So in the aftermath of that conflict, there are many people in Texas and who are interested in Texas, elsewhere in Mexico, that begin to say, look, we have to do something serious about this region. We have to find a way to actually begin to develop it economically and demographically. And they debated various schemes. Perhaps we could find a large population of Europeans who were already Catholic that would want to come. These and other plans always failed, and so the obvious answer was always the only one left, and that was we can allow colonization from the United States. So there's really a kind of an interesting dynamic here, which is that Texas was a difficult place, in part because Indians were so powerful, and so they wanted to have colonists come in order partly to check Indian power. But the main reason that thinkers in Mexico City wanted to see Texas developed and wanted to see a large population of loyal Mexicans there was that they feared that the United States would eventually come and take this territory and then perhaps maybe even threaten more essential interests further south in Mexico. So there's this linkage between powerful Indian peoples and the fear of U.S. expansion from the very beginning in the decisions that went into allowing for Moses Austin and then Stephen Austin to bring American colonists into Texas.
Of course, the irony there is that as more and more Americans came into Texas, ultimately Texas decided it wanted to be independent of Mexico.
Yeah, precisely. And, of course, there were many people in Mexico who predicted precisely this when these conversations were happening in the 1820s. But their critics would always say, well, sure, there's always a possibility that that will happen. But if we can provide them good government, cheap land, and freedom, why would you expect that they would have their allegiance maintained to the United States? I mean, it certainly was the case that there were many Americans in previous decades who had voluntarily decided to become Spaniards because land was cheaper there. So I think there were good arguments for allowing American immigration into Texas, even though it ended so disastrously, and many people afterwards were able to say, well, look, you know, we predicted this, and here it's come to pass. They really didn't have a lot of other choices because otherwise Texas would have remained an extremely sparsely populated place that was almost entirely controlled by Native peoples.
So meanwhile, how was the United States monitoring the situation from Washington?
Well, this is one of the parts of the story that surprised me the most, and that is that beginning in 1835, 1836 with the Texas Rebellion, Americans, broadly speaking, began paying attention to northern Mexico, to Texas, and then northern Mexico more generally, really for the first time. There were always sort of the oddball speculators or people that had a great enthusiasm for land out west that were interested in Texas and had talked about it for a time. But in terms of, you know, newspapers in Ohio or Massachusetts talking about Texas commonly or giving news about northern Mexico, this just didn't happen until the Texas Rebellion. But that event really crystallized interest in the region. So Americans began turning their attention to northern Mexico in 1836. This is right at the moment where warfare between independent Native peoples and Mexicans is really accelerating at a rapid pace. And so this becomes the key observation in American minds, both for American politicians, people in the diplomatic corps, regular readers of newspapers throughout the country, authors of memoirs and travel literature and so forth, this notion that Mexicans are falling back before Indians. And this, what's important here, I think, is to remember the moment in which this is happening. I mean, this is the same generation of Americans who orchestrated and executed Indian removal, forcing these powerful native peoples east of the Mississippi after, you know, centuries of conflict. And so the idea that history was running in reverse in Mexico becomes this powerful refrain that we hear again and again through all kinds of different sources in the United States. And this is going to become a really crucial component of the way in which the American government and the American people think about Mexico in advance of the war.
So Americans essentially have this sort of colossally ethnocentric view that we can beat Indians anywhere. And if the Indians down in Mexico can beat the Mexicans, we certainly can beat the Mexicans.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, it's really interesting how the hierarchy works in their minds. People who talked at some length about this, about trying to assess the relative powers of different peoples in North America, would say things along the lines of, well, we all know that the Shawnees and the Delawares are some of the greatest warriors anywhere in the continent, and obviously we've beaten them. And the Shawnees and the Delawares, after we push them west, well, they commonly beat huge, large, much larger parties of Comanches and Apaches. Therefore, the Comanches are worse than the Shawnees and the Delawares, who we beat, and the Comanches are beating Mexicans. You know, so that we'll just be able to roll right through this place and take whatever we want, because there's something fundamentally wrong with Mexicans. And of course, in the day, the notion of what was wrong with Mexicans was fairly clear to everyone, and that is that they were a people of mixed blood, mixed heritage. They were a mongrel people, as they were called, in the United States, and this helped explain their inability to protect themselves and their families against these really pathetic Indian peoples.
Brian DeLay is my guest. He's assistant professor of history at the University of Colorado at Boulder. His new book is called War of a Thousand Deserts, Indian Raids and the U.S.-Mexican War. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So obviously, if this was the perspective, Brian, the idea was always from the Americans that once they defeated Mexico and had political claim to the territory, there was never any question that they planned to sort of move the native peoples out to wherever was convenient for the Americans.
Yeah, absolutely. And this was, you know, this is an interesting assumption that was most widely held by people who didn't know anything about the region or about these Indians. And it was borne out in most Americans' minds by history. You know, yes, we've had certain setbacks here and there in our struggles against native peoples, but the trajectory was very clear, and it runs in one way. And we are victorious. We decide where they can go and when they should go. And the same is certainly going to happen once we acquire new territories further west. So there, most people, again, people who did not have a lot of familiarity with the native peoples of the region, just took this as a given. It was not even something that was really a matter of great debate. It was just going to happen. Interestingly, by 1846, when the war begins, you know, Texas is, of course, a state at that point, and the representatives from Texas, although they have no doubts about, you know, the ability of Texans to defeat Indians and so forth, they, when it comes down to it, they know quite a lot more about northern Mexico, about the difficult environment that the Americans are going to find when they get there in the southern plains and the dry southwest, and about how formidable native peoples actually can be, all rhetoric aside. And so, you know, where they're in this interesting situation where they're the first to say, well, of course, the Texans are going to be able to defeat any Indians with relative ease. But then when the United States government begins talking seriously about the obligations it might incur if it defeats Mexico in war to control Indians, Texans begin backpedaling and saying, well, wait a minute, this is going to be a lot harder than you think. And they, of course, are the people that speak with authority, and they know what they're talking about.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Paul in Hearst. Hi, Paul.
Well, hi. Yeah, my question, wondering if Cormac McCarthy in, say, Blood Meridian, you know, the popular novelist, if his fictional accounts, are these somewhat, do they approximate what actually happened? And, of course, some of his novels bleed over into the 20th century, but I think a great deal of the border raiding and counter-raiding that he writes of is from this period, 1835 to 1845, 50.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I first read Blood Meridian before I began this project, and I was, you know, totally entranced by it, horrified by it, 'cause it's a very difficult book, but a really wonderful book. And after I'd finished the research for this project, I went back and reread Blood Meridian, and I was amazed by how true it was to the facts. In fact, I could see where Cormac McCarthy got inspiration from, what sort of primary documents and classic texts and stuff. So he's right on about much of this. I mean, of course, there's a degree of embellishment here, but the violence that he describes and the cheapness of human life and the degree to which different groups of people went after each other for profit is absolutely true, and these things predated the U.S.-Mexican War and for a period only intensified after the U.S.-Mexican War. So Blood Meridian is really true to life.
Did these different tribes ever come together in order to achieve economic ends or to fight off Anglo settlers in any capacity?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the major themes of this book is this argument that we can't just look at Indians as these incidental, disorganized actors who, through indirect ways, influence the contest between Mexico and the United States. It seems to me that we have to take their own political and economic context very seriously. And when we do, really we see people who are capable of organizing themselves and cooperating across different kinds of boundaries with really astonishing effectiveness. This is one of the reasons that Comanches, for example, were so formidable, is that they would sometimes send parties of several hundred, even 1,000 men, nearly 1,000 miles away from their home ranges to campaign through Mexican territory that was, you know, very difficult to traverse and quite dangerous because, of course, they're down there trying to despoil everyone that they meet. But they were able to do so because they were so effective at coordinating their energies. And they do so across different kinds of divisions. Later on, after the Americans take this territory, there are, of course, all kinds of examples in the so-called Plains Wars where different linguistic groups, different tribal peoples come together and try to cooperate against expanding American power.
Let's talk for a minute about what you call the Texas creation myth. What was it and how did it influence the way Texans and Americans in general looked at their earliest history?
Well, the Texas creation myth is a set of stories that Texans told, primarily non-Texans, about their past. And so when Texas began its revolt against Mexico, it knew that support from the United States was really going to be critical. It would be great if they could get men from the United States, of course, but most especially they needed money and they needed arms and weapons. And to do that, they needed to both promote the cause and counter a particular kind of argument that was coming mainly out of New England, that these folks in Texas were just bandits and slaveholders, that they had mischievously and perhaps in a premeditated way come to Mexico, and just once they had critical numbers, they were going to throw off Mexican rule in order to have a vast slave state. So they needed to craft a counter-narrative, Austin did, and others that were key leaders in the movement. So Austin himself actually is sent to the United States in the midst of the war to try to drum up support for the rebellion. And he addresses many crowds throughout the United States. And he begins almost all of his talks with a very brief history lesson. And he gives what he considers to be, or what he claims are, the essentials of the Texan history. And the story, very much compressed, is basically that prior to the arrival of Anglo-Americans, there were only handfuls of Spaniards and later Mexicans in Texas. They were surrounded on all sides by Indian peoples who constantly plundered them and attacked their families. And despairing of ever doing anything with this territory, the Mexican government invited American colonists in to subdue the Indians because they knew that American colonists had a genius when it came to this. So American colonists came in, subdued the Indians, and gave protection not only to Texas, which then quickly became a kind of garden paradise, but also gave protection to other parts of Mexico by interposing a barrier between the Indians and Mexicans south of the river. So this is what Austin says, and then this same theme is picked up on by Texas's diplomats to Washington. It's picked up on by historians who are writing the earliest histories of Texas. It's picked up on even by American congressmen who are mostly Southerners who are great proponents of Texas. And it just becomes this essential part of the conversation that in order to justify the rebellion and justify Texas's right to have independence, this narrative that involved Indians was really central to that entire construction. And then that lays the groundwork for American expectations about what Anglo-Americans elsewhere, you know, if a few scraggly Anglo-American pioneers in Texas could do this, imagine what the American military would be able to do once we get into northern Mexico more broadly.
So it also sort of leads to the idea of convincing ourselves that this sovereign nation is better off under our control.
Oh, there's no question about that. That was, an important thing that Texans had to convince Americans of. I don't doubt for a second that Texans believed it themselves, that they believed that this land would be better off under our care than under Mexican care, and certainly that they would be better off under their own leadership than under Mexico City's leadership. They certainly believed that. But there is a degree of conscious self-crafting and storytelling here that is calculated to make a certain kind of impression on American readers and American listeners. You know, in Texas itself, one of the most common complaints in the midst of the rebellion, and this is the stories that Texans tell each other, or told each other at the time, was that one of the reasons that they needed to rebel was that the Mexican government refused to provide them protection against Indians. So you see the degree to which this is sort of a self-conscious, mythical creation, this story of the Texas creation myth.
What do we know about what the Indians were thinking at this time, under which government they'd be better off?
Well, very little is the answer to that. We do have these tantalizing glimpses of conversations that Native peoples had with non-Natives about the looming contest between Texas, the United States, and Mexico. And some of these Native informants, including some Comanches who were interviewed in New Mexico by a Mexican general, say, well, we see what the Americans do to our land. We see what they do to buffalo. And we recognize that we're much better off under Mexico than we are under the United States. But the fact is that these raids are continuing, they're even accelerating, and it seems clear that the majority of Comanches simply do not think that way, that they are so focused on their own story and their own narrative that this contest between these distant governments, whose representatives they only ever see on a very occasional basis, is simply not that important to them.
Brian DeLay is with us. His new book is called War of a Thousand Deserts, Indian Raids and the U.S.-Mexican War. We'll return to your questions in just a moment. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can follow your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Brian DeLay. His new book is called War of a Thousand Deserts, Indian Raids and the U.S.-Mexican War. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Let's speak next to Justin in Dallas. Hey, Justin.
Hi. Brian, I was wondering, my family is from South Texas, Benavides, and we've always had in our oral history the stories of Indian raids, in their small settlement. It was a small ranching community. And what's been absent from this oral history has always been these major wars and Texas becoming a republic and the United States taking Texas and Mexico. And I was wondering how many of these small communities there are that are small agricultural communities where the settlers have just lived their life and have been border jumped, you know, Mexican, then American, then Texan. How many of those small communities are like that?
Wow. Lots and lots, the answer. Because, of course, you know, even prior to the changes that you talk about, there was the change from being part of the Empire of Spain into being part of the Independent Republic of Mexico. So, you know, in individuals' lifetimes, if they're born at the right time, they could have grown up under Spain and then been part of the Republic of Mexico and part of the Republic of Texas, and part of the United States, and then finally part of the Confederacy, you know, if they live long enough, and then again part of the United States once the Civil War concludes. So absolutely, there are lots of families, lots of towns, lots of ranching communities, especially in South Texas, I would say, who have experienced all of these transformations, and all the while their local history is rooted into this complex relationship between themselves and Native peoples living around them and all these different people who are moving in and out.
An email from Dan asks if you would talk about the treatment of Native Americans by the Mexican government during this period.
Sure. Well, you know, it varies tremendously from group to group. So, you know, I should probably begin by saying that the majority of native peoples in Mexico, the vast majority, were sedentary native peoples who had become integrated into New Spain and later into the Mexican population. And they were absolutely at the bottom of society. They were the poorest people in the country. They were the people with the least political power. And they were greatly feared by most of Mexico's leaders because there was certainly a potential that they would rise up against people who had all the resources, political and otherwise. So that's one, you know, that's the most important, the largest group. As for these independent Indian peoples, again, it really varies by context. As I said at the beginning of the hour, Navajos were locked in a really terrible struggle with New Mexicans that was fed partly by Mexican captive taking, and, you know, Navajos would respond, oftentimes, I think, in hopes of recovering lost kin. And then Mexican parties would go in there with many hundreds of people, including Pueblo warriors, Pueblo Indian warriors, and lay waste to different parts of Navajo territory, kill people, take animals, cut down orchards, and so forth. You know, Apaches and Mexicans, same thing. You know, there's all kinds of stories about Mexicans doing horrible things to Apaches, including betraying promises of peace and safety during peace negotiations, where, you know, dozens of people would be massacred in cold blood after they had been brought in under the flag of truce. So, you know, it's important for me to say that I'm certainly not arguing that there's one group here that is morally superior to another. This is really a grim story of people with the power to take what they want from others doing so. And it doesn't break along ethnic lines, as far as I can see.
I have an email from David in Plano who asks, many of the generals who commanded troops in the American Civil War also fought in the Mexican-American War, typically as junior officers. What effect did that conflict have on their tactics as leaders of troops in combat, and how did that war affect their attitudes toward how they should manage these tribes out west as America expanded after the Civil War?
That's a great question, and it's not one that I can speak a whole lot about in regards to the Civil War and actual military tactics in the Civil War, other than to state the obvious, which is that this was a crucial crucial experience for many of the future officers of the Confederacy and of the Union, and, you know, including the most prominent generals in the war, who took part in this conflict and, you know, was absolutely crucial in their formative stages. As to how the war influenced the way they viewed Native peoples, you know, that's a fascinating question that I don't think we understand well enough yet, and I certainly can't claim to understand all that well. It is true that there were many officers, both volunteer and part of the regular army, in northern Mexico, and here I'm speaking only about northern Mexico because this is where the violence was taking place between Indians and Mexicans, who were appalled by what they saw there on the ground and really did feel a sense of obligation, perhaps, or a desire to intervene when it was convenient to do so in conflicts between Indians and Mexicans, and were certainly moved to pity in certain cases to help Mexicans. More broadly, though, I would say that the crucial thing about this ongoing conflict, the War of a Thousand Deserts, as I've called it, between Indians and Mexicans when the Americans arrive, the American military arrives, is that it is immensely useful to the Americans, as they knew it would be. Because after all, they're marching through this exhausted, shattered landscape in the U.S.-Mexican War, which makes its conquest far easier and crucially makes its occupation much, much easier because American generals and officers come to settlements all across the North and say, well, we're not here to fight you, and indeed, we'll even protect you against Indians as long as you remain quiet and don't give any material support to the Mexican army.